This podcast is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Visit darkmyths.org to discover more shows like this one. The darkness awaits.
Hello and welcome to the Not Alone podcast. I am your host, Sam Fredrickson.
Along with Jason Moitoso.
Jason's over there at the end of the 6-foot divide. Jason, you sound distraught.
Sam, I'm just coming to the realization that I have to accept the fact that we're talking about UFOs and aliens again.
We're not even just talking about that. See, the majority... If you're not aware, this is the third in what was supposed to be a 3-part series on aliens and the Cold War, and the majority of what we talked about was like, oh, the craft themselves, or maybe like a telepathic thing, or this or that.
Yeah, but you don't know how to edit content.
If you thought that last week was crazy, as we talked about Ed Mitchell and the contiguous universe that is... subservient to a higher power that has zero-point energy machines, that's just the beginning of crazy. Or, to be fair, that's the end of crazy.
Oh, thank
God. And today, we're going to look at the beginning. And we're going to move into the middle. And then we might end up at the end.
Where we started. Okay.
We might end up where we started. Because today, we are going to broach a phenomena that I typically don't give the time of day. But... It's impossible for me to talk about how the idea of extraterrestrials affected the Cold War and vice versa without talking about the contactees. That's what they're called.
You are way too excited about this.
I'm dead inside.
Perfect.
I'm having to manufacture this because, like I told you and the patrons right before we started, at about 6 o'clock last night, I was like, all right, okay, wait. I have too much content for one episode, but not enough content for two episodes. So instead, I went ahead and I doubled everything that I had. I found two additional subjects to talk about, and I split it down the middle. So
Sam,
this was supposed to be...
double spacing, double line spacing.
That's not...
That's how you double it,
audio
right?
Mediums don't conform to font type and spacing.
Oh.
This was supposed to be part 3 of a 3-part series. It is now part 3 of a 4-part series. But to be fair, the second part, or the third part, is... what am I trying to say?
This is going
to
last as long
as the Cold War. The third and fourth parts are one part. They're just... they're one subject split into two pieces.
It's part 3 in 3.5?
3A and 3B is what I'm going to title them in the actual show notes.
Can I just choose
stuff.
C now?
Yes. C is...
always the correct answer, right?
C is all of the above. And we do everything again. So today, we're going to talk about the contactees. This group of people. Now, we're going to get started here with a callback to a call forward from last week. Now, if you'll remember, I mentioned a little something about Ed Mitchell... well, we talked a lot about Ed Mitchell, but we mentioned specifically how he talked about an event of a UFO over White Sands Proving Ground in New Mexico. And this, of course, is where the first atomic bomb was tested and this and that. And this is the story that we're going to look at first today. First of two stories we're going to look at. Well, two of four total before all of this is done. Now, this case... is that of Daniel Fry. Fry is another one of these enigmas of a person. He's very highly qualified. He's quite literally a rocket scientist. But he claimed some truly, truly astonishing things. Now, What's important to note, nowadays it's almost commonplace to talk first and foremost about the aliens in the saucers, but in 1949, the saucers themselves were still a relatively new phenomena. And even as time progressed with open-minded individuals like Captain Ruppelt and J. Allen Hynek, these people who really led the official charge into ufology, people who, by the end of their careers, really had no problem, and with Hynek, really relish the opportunity to say that these were craft of an unknown origin coming from someplace unknown, headed to someplace unknown. And yet to talk about the people inside them, even to someone like Hynek, who at the end of his life believed that these may or may not be the physical manifestations of psychic energy coming from another realm, to talk about the people inside them still seems crass. And I use the word people quite liberally, in some cases. But Daniel Fry didn't have a problem with that because he talked to him. He communicated with him. So let's get to his story here. Now,
yeah, story. I like how you phrased it that way.
Now, Fry's story comes from us starting on July 4th, 1949, when he was working at the White Sands Proving Grounds in New Mexico. Now, like we mentioned, this was the home of the Trinity testing site. It was the first place that the face of the Earth was ever exposed to nuclear detonation. And it's often pointed to as an interplanetary hotspot, exactly the place where if aliens, if they are in fact visiting the Earth, could be expected to be watching at any given time. Now, Fry, during this time, was living at the base as well, which definitely wasn't unusual. He was planning on catching a bus from the facility to a nearby town in order to partake in some Independence Day debauchery. But he just barely missed it and was relegated to a night of boredom and watching fireworks from about 10 miles away. So, instead, he decides, okay, I'll just hang out in my room. I'll just read. He's the kind of man who doesn't make his own party, and I respect that. I am also the kind of man who does not make my own party.
What do you mean by that?
Some people, if left to their own devices, will go around the base and be like, "Oh, Schmitty, you also didn't go on the bus. Oh, Harold, you're here too. We can all hang out and have a party together." Other people, like me.
So what you're saying is that some people are social. And then there's you and me.
And you. Thank you very much,
Mr. 6 feet away for a reason.
Yeah. This is the closest we can be together without it affecting our bubbles of personal space. Yeah. So what I'm trying to say is that Daniel Fry was a lot like me, I would say, in more ways than one, as we'll talk about here. In fact, right here, where he decides that instead of just sitting alone in his room all night, he's not going to interact with people, and I respect that, but he is going to go wander in the desert, which is, of course, the only...
It's where you die.
No.
That's... Or do drugs. I'm following.
It is the only tried and true method of seeing a UFO, walking into the desert at night, despite the fact that I have spent many a night in the desert and have yet to be contacted face to face. Still, balls in your court, Xanathor, Lord of the Galactic, whatever.
What?
I don't know. So, the real reason, he didn't have the harebrained idea of I'm going into the desert. The real reason was his air conditioning was broken and it was hot and stuffy in his room. So he figured he'd just go outside for some fresh air. And as he did, he stood facing these are real. I looked these up. They're called the Oregon Mountains, not Oregon, not Oregon, Oregon. Like
what's
your
in
intestines.
Our okay.
So that's what they decided to call these mountains for some reason. Frickin' sickos. And he just examined the beauty of these Oregon Mountains, as well as the brilliance of the stars glistening over the mountain peaks, when suddenly the biggest, brightest star, which was straight in front of him, simply appeared to go out. Now he strains to see what's happening here. He realizes that there's a shape a void, a blackness moving towards him in the dark. And as it got closer and closer, he was able to distinguish a specific form. And what he saw, he described as an oblate spheroid. Spheroid. Oblate spheroid. So that means... So,
like an egg?
Almost? Yes,
like an okay, egg, like an oval.
But specifically, the bottom of the egg and the top of the eggs were just like leveled off.
Oh.
Yeah, it was weird. So.
Okay.
And this is coming towards him.
So it's like pre-squish flying saucer.
Exactly.
It's still tall.
Exactly. They just yeah. grabbed it a little bit. And he saw that it was 30 feet in diameter and 16 foot high, making its way directly towards him.
It's pretty heavy.
It's pretty big, to say the least.
Which means it's probably pretty heavy.
Now, the spheroid came within arm's reach of him. It started by...
Did he touch it?
Almost directly overhead and then
Did
coming
touch
down.
The butt?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
That was his first very human instinct, was to reach out and touch... space.
Reach out.
Yeah, touch. I know. Thank you.
And, I'm sorry. Okay.
No, that was I'm exactly what I wanted. So he goes to reach out and he notices...
How dare you play me like that?
He notices that his hand seems to touch the thing, but it's almost slippery. Like he can't keep his hand... Yeah, he can't keep it in one place. It's like... all over the place.
Whoa.
And then he hears a voice right next to him. Now, this is important, okay? When we're communicating with people in craft, a lot of times the voice comes from within the head. You hear it in your head. That's what happened with Ed Walters. That's what happened with Whitley Strieber. These things resonate within your dome. But that was not the case for Daniel Fry. This voice came directly to his left out of the air. That he describes it as coming out of the air itself, as if there was in fact some sort of an invisible man just standing right next to him. And the voice says, "You better not touch the hole, pal. It's still hot." Now, Fry, as you might imagine, was very surprised by this. And he jumps backwards. He actually trips over his own over his own heels and lands on his back in the sand. And the voice speaks again. It says, "Take it easy, pal. You're among friends."
"No, I'm not. Oh, no. You go away, friend.
You go away." Now, Fry gets himself up and doesn't... So you can read his entire account, which is like 60 pages. It's called the White Sands Incident. It's free online. I'll link to it because we are just brushing the surface on a lot of this. But like, he gets up and he doesn't seem, at least he doesn't let on that he is freaked out by this. He's like, "Well, there's a hovering craft above me, and there's a voice coming out to the left, speaking in the cadence of the day. Seems totally normal." And so he starts just talking back to the air. And he and the disembodied person then have a conversation regarding the whole of the spaceship, whether it was physically hot, right? Because that's what he said. It's
right.
Still hot. Is it heated up? Or... because of Fry's work as a rocket man would lead him to think, maybe he meant radioactively hot, meaning it was bristling with radioactivity. Now, the voice told him that the hole was not radioactive, but instead it used a sort of a matter repulsion field to avoid being damaged in takeoff or landing or on flight. Now, it's important to remember, that's not what's causing it to fly. It's not flying through a matter of repulsion. It's basically an outer coating, the same way you would put an anti scuff.
So it's like all almost magnetized? No.
No, it's...
It's not, it does, it... Wait, it's not like a... It's a physical barrier, not like a...
It's a... It's
not like a force field.
It is a force field.
It is a force field.
It is a force field, but okay. That's not how it's flying. Okay. Right? Because I would think that it like repulses matter away from it, and that's like how it flies and stuff or whatever. It's not. It's literally, yeah. It's literally just like scuff coating, I don't know, something that you would scuff coat. Can you scuff coat? I've said scuff coat too much.
Yeah, you have. I'm like, it doesn't. Man, sound that'd be great on my windshield, so I never get another nick from a rock again.
Exactly. Or you know what I'm thinking of when I say scuff coat? I'm thinking if I could just get them to leave me alone.
That's what I'm thinking of.
I'm thinking of oleophobic or hydrophobic. Have you ever seen shoes?
Yeah.
That's exactly just what it is.
Melts right off.
It just slips right off.
Yeah.
Which is why his hand was just going every which way and this and that. Not because he was touching the thing, but because, according to the voice, it's a distance of only a few microns. He was stopping and just touching air. And so he didn't have any resistance.
It's a micron.
A micron is a very, very small unit of measurement.
Okay. I was going to say, there's a few micron. There's one micron here.
Micron is a worldwide chip-making company that is headquartered in Boise, Idaho. So he says, well, what does that matter? If it's not physically hot and if it's not radioactive, why does it matter if I touch it or not? And this is really interesting to me, is that what we're about to see is a man who talks to a disembodied voice that has all of the answers. And yet this is the answer that he doesn't have. The disembodied voice says, we don't know why, but it seems to negatively affect humans. Now, if you do it for a second or a minute or so, that's not too bad. But really anything above a minute and a half, you will die. It will slowly produce something in your blood that will destroy you. And we don't know why this happens, but it does, so please just don't touch the hull of the ship. And he says, well, okay. Now, from there, they talk about psychology or something, mainly beginning with what has and will forever be the continual leitmotif of the aliens in these stories and countless others, which is, you're gonna blow yourselves up, and we, the aliens, are doing our darndest to make sure that this does not happen. And guess what, Mr. Fry? Mr. My room's too hot, so I'm going to go outside and stand in the desert air on
you
the 4th of
AC?
July. We do have a climate-controlled spaceship, but you're a part of this now.
Oh,
you're in on the plan.
Weird that this is the first time I've ever heard of his name.
Right?
Good job. Way to be an activist.
Way to be the guy. We, the aliens, envision a day. I'm going to speak as the aliens if I didn't make that clear. We, the aliens, we envision a day where we can metaphorically and also literally land our craft on the White House lawn and announce to the world, hello, we are here. We love you. You are going to be fine. But here's the problem. That's going to take at least 4 years. Now, I know that seems like a weird, arbitrary number for you.
This president you just voted in, not our guy.
Not our guy.
The next one.
He's going to be the
unless
one.
He gets reelected. Then, then it's a different topic.
Then 4 more years.
Yeah.
What we're looking at is it is going to take our alien bodies 4 more years to be able to change in order to survive in your natural habitat, and we're gonna need you to do the heavy lifting.
Man, they must reproduce like crazy.
Yeah, that's the thing, is I don't think that's what they're talking about. I think they're implying that their bodies are going to physically change, like individually.
Ooh.
So there's that, I guess. No, I don't think it's just that they're gonna go through like a million
evolution
generations in
hey,
4 years.
You never know.
It could be.
We only live for 24 hours.
And Mr. Fry, you're going to be the man to do it while we're working on it. But before, do it as in spread the good news.
Yeah.
That we're
okay.
Here to stop
it, that just
you
sounded
from
weird.
Yourself.
I'm sorry.
I understand. It is weird.
It is all strange.
It's all very strange. But before we get into that, how would you like to see the inside of a spaceship? Now,
all right, little tyke, you've been good all day.
All right, buddy. Come on.
Come on in the spaceship.
Now, as you might imagine, Mr. Fry was more than ready for this, and he jumped at the opportunity. As he boards the ship, though, he notes that it is strangely empty. And he says, "Where are you? Who am I talking to?" Which I think would be the first thing you say when a disembodied voice cracks out of the thin air beside you, but it took him a little longer. And the voice returns and says, "My name, he doesn't say this, it's spelled Alan, A-L-A-N, but it is pronounced Alon. And I am the pilot of the mothership, high above the earth. This here is a lowly cargo craft used mainly to sample your planet's air and earth. Not necessarily meant for manual flight, but just in case, we do have this charming little chamber here, which, as you can see, is about 9 by 7 feet. And there are 4 chairs, 4 seats, all of which seem to resemble, and this is my words and not Fry's or Alon's, seem to resemble a captain's chair in Star Trek."
So, hold on.
Okay.
They have a drone.
Yes.
That still has seats in it.
Yes.
Just in case.
Just in case. Because here's the thing, Mr. Fry. You're not the first human we've talked to, but...
And usually they like to sit down.
Usually it's thirsty work standing for hours talking to us. Usually the reason that they don't talk to as many people as maybe we think they should is that, and I love, this is just such a common theme in all of the contactee stories, is that the other people, normal people, their minds aren't as honed as yours are. They're not as clear. They're not as able to understand. And we knew that you'd be able to understand.
Oh, yeah. He's special.
He's special. He's the chosen one. Now, what's quite interesting, and Jason, I think you'll get a kick out of this.
Oh, good.
Is that the reason that he's special is not particularly because he is very, very smart. Instead, what it is that he doesn't really believe all the way. He knows the concept of, but he doesn't believe all the way in universal scientific laws. So the reason why other scientists and other normal people can't talk to the aliens is because the aliens are impossible. They can't exist and they can't do the things that they say they can do and can be demonstrated doing because it's against the natural laws. So because Mr. Fry doesn't believe in set natural laws, that's why he gets selected to work with the aliens.
Okay. I think I'm done here.
Just go ahead, pack up. I'll just do the rest myself.
Keep going. They are laws for a reason. They are tested. They are tried. They are true.
But...
And that's really frustrating.
The other side of it is that if...
Please. What is the other side?
Yes, I will. I will. Thank you.
Enlighten.
If a law cannot adequately explain all of the anomalies in the universe, it cannot be a law. And so these cases, even if they're just one-offs of craft that are maneuvering in ways that are physically
all these
impossible,
that are being witnessed by the naked eye.
Stop. It's fine. We're going to get there. Because they are maneuvering in ways that are inconsistent with the laws of science, it means that the laws of science, while good, are not complete.
It's that kind of thinking. That does not move us forward.
What's it do to us?
It makes us worse in every way. But continue.
I agree. Now, this mothership hovering above Earth has been there for thousands of years. Thousands and thousands of years. Which it really kind of doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Why, if they've been there for thousands of years, they're only 4 years away from, like...
They're almost there, man.
Yeah. I feel
this
like...
This makes more sense, then. I don't know how they toned it down to 4 years, but...
I feel like they either can or cannot, and there shouldn't be a waiting period after thousands of years. But, so be it. That's where they were. Now, Alon offers to really open up the anti-grav drive on this cargo ship and show Fry what it can do with a visit to Earth's most beautiful location, New York City, which is the worst. If you know me at all, this is the point where I officially lose my typical air of credulity when it comes to these stories, simply because New York City is the worst place I've ever been. And joke's on you, guy.
Not that bad.
Wait, joke's on you, guy who tweeted at me not an hour ago saying that I probably wasn't going to mention Dogman in this episode. It is the first place I saw a Dogman. In an alleyway, waiting for me.
Was it dark?
And it haunts me. No, it was light. It was bright. And I saw a dog man in New York City. And it haunts me to this day. Those were in the notes already before that guy said I wasn't going to talk about dog man, but I'm just telling you.
Oh, I know.
I'm always going to talk about dog man.
I looked him over.
That's true, you did. Now,
this is why I'm sad.
According to Elon, however, New York had so much to offer, and really, when you see its lights from space, it infuses you with a romantic belief in the capability of man. It gets you to understand just what marvelous creatures human beings are, that they could create something so luminous in the darkness of space.
Who are you?
I'm Elon, and I hate him.
Okay. I was going to say, you're starting to sound like a real douche.
That's fair.
Like, if I heard you use that voice when I was, like, I don't know, at a fancy dinner party or something, like, that guy.
That guy's, he's the worst.
I'm done. No more of him. We're good here.
Now, here's something that's interesting. First off, Elon says, this is where we're going to go. And Fry says, well, here's the thing, right? This little
light of mine.
This little 9x7 room, as you call it, I call it a cell, is basically a broom closet. Doesn't even have any windows. And that's just like a level of bold, brash, brazen. Like, I hope when I get up to the frickin' spaceship for the first time, I'm like, look at how crappy it is here. This sucks. You make a terrible spaceship.
Were they like, windows are structural weaknesses?
They said something a little different.
Okay.
They say is, well, if you're so Mr. Smarty Pants, what we're going to do is we're going to take you to New York. Okay. And you're going to see it. Just believe me here. And we're going to take you at 8,000 miles per hour. Now, this is where Fry lets him down a little bit and says, but that's impossible. And then they come back with, you fool, nothing's impossible. And then they go. And they
and
go.
Those G-forces liquidize him.
Yeah, exactly. Literally, his first response is, there's not even seatbelts in this thing. It's like, all right, Mr. Hoity-toity high and mighty. So they go. They make it to New York in 30 minutes. But as they go, something quite remarkable happens. The steel or gray, it's like a grayish interior of the ship. It just fades away. And suddenly the entire ship has become translucent, almost as if the ship itself is invisible.
Has Fry become Wonder Woman?
Yes, exactly. Next up, they give him the lasso of truth, and he uses it on himself to really admit what's going on here. But he flies through the air, and because the ship is quote-unquote invisible, it's as though he is flying through the air, unaided. It is beautiful. It is brilliant.
But he's sitting down, right?
He is sitting down, yes. So you can get, woo! Is that a man in the chair in the air? What's going on up there?
Whoa.
And I'm a poet. And it's 4th of July as well. He doesn't mention this, but I would assume that he almost gets shot by a frickin' firework like 5,000 times. But just imagine that. You have like the big finale and just in front of the big finale is the silhouette of a man just flying through the air in front of your small town fireworks show. That would be something. And it would probably make the news, which it didn't. There's no reports of this externally. But of course, there
that
wouldn't be. There wouldn't be.
No.
No. So they make it over New York. And he's like, wow, this is really something. It's scientifically impossible, but it must be possible. There must truly be no universal laws. And in reality, everything is in a state of flux. Everything is wild. But if Fry thought that this was the most shocking thing that would happen to him that night, he was stupid as a rock. Because as he got up from his seat, he realizes that emblazoned on all four of these Star Trek captain chairs is an insignia. It's an insignia of a serpent and a tree. And he said that this rocked him to his very core because he understood the significance of these symbols. He instantly equated them with the Jewish story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. And at this point, Fry started demanding some answers that I'm frankly shocked it took him so long to find the questions for. Who exactly are you people? Where did you come from? What is your relation to the humans of Earth? And now Alon becomes suspiciously time-sensitive for a guy with anti-gravity technology, saying, well, we don't really have time to get into this and that, and I was going to tell you on our next visit, but I guess I'll just give you the overview, as it were. Were you? We're Earthlings from the past. We are human.
So why do they have to climatize?
And you are us. Just, you'll get there.
Okay.
According to Alon, their ancestors were, and here's a buzzword for y'all. Their ancestors were the Lemurians. Remember Lemuria?
Unfortunately.
Continent in the Indian Ocean, yep. Sunken. And they had been at war with the other scientific superpower of their day. Jason, can I get a guess?
Atlantis,
the Atlantean. Now, these two continental powers continued to outdo each other scientifically with achievement after achievement, starting with a friendly sort of competition and ending with an all-out rubbing it in the face of each other. And so finally, all-out war broke.
This would make an amazing Netflix series.
Right? It really would. And when they did, they succeeded in making the Earth entirely uninhabitable through their weapons and their means. And a meeting was held high upon the plateau of Tibet. And the survivors of war had to decide what was now to be done.
You know, it's weird. You think geologists would be able to find that.
Find what?
Evidence of that a civilization? The world was uninhabitable.
Well, here's what I have to say about that. Why are there no people once you get back past like 60,000 years? Because it was uninhabited. Because it was uninhabitable. Dinosaurs don't count.
That wasn't thousands of years ago. That was millions of years
ago. So after the dinosaurs.
Yes.
But before us.
I talked about monkeys. I talked about swamp apes.
That's
and
true.
Whatnot.
I'm sorry, I forgot. That was like 40 episodes ago.
It took a long time for basically a shrew to become a primate.
Sure.
All right, that's all I got.
I'm going to get back to the...
It's uninhabitable.
I'm going to come back to the story. Thank you.
The story. Now, emphasis on story.
There were six ships. And these ships I like to think of as like the Nebuchadnezzar in the Matrix, where like it's essentially a space navy ship. It's huge. People live in it. When we say six ships, we mean like six different fragments of civilization. Four of them left for Mars. Three of them made it to Mars. The last two stayed behind on Earth, working and waiting beyond the atmosphere for the great wheel of time to turn and for the planet to become habitable once again. And once it did, they seeded on the Earth in a literal Garden of Eden, the human race. It was this exact fate that was replaying itself again, either as a universal law akin to the Great Filter, however we know that there are no universal laws, or else then it must be something dark in the hearts of man. But this time, the aliens were determined not to let it come to pass.
So why haven't we seen anything on the Martian planet? surface and whatnot, like structures.
Again, it depends on who you ask.
Ah.
Because if you ask Andrew DiBasiago, he has identified 6 subspecies of alien, as well as a literal buttload of Egyptian-inspired arts and monuments on the Martian surface. But Big NASA doesn't want you to know.
Okay.
I know. This did turn into more of a conspiracies Jason just doesn't understand than I thought it would. But I do know that you hate this. And I know you're going to hate next week even more.
Oh,
so
great.
It's good, though.
I'll bring alcohol next time.
Yeah. So Daniel Fry was called one of the first apostles of a gospel of intergalactic peace, but he would not be the last. As time went on, he spread the good word of Elon and the overlords, and to this end, he established a foundation, Understanding Incorporated. The name comes from one of Elon and Fry's conversations, wherein Elon explained that the Bible was mistranslated, and that every time the word love was used, it should have been understand. See, if one understands God, he cannot help but to love God.
Wait.
And if one truly understands himself and his neighbor, and is truly understood by his neighbor and himself, there is no opportunity for anything other than love to occur between them.
Okay, so you read love twice in that passage. And if love is supposed to be understand,
understanding brings love. So,
No. What I'm getting at,
yes,
is if it was translated,
right,
why were 2 different words being used for love at any point in time?
There's a whole lot of reasons as to why you have good questions like that, because this is fake for a whole lot of reasons, not to mention the very fundamental of Jewish theology, which is that God is unable to be understood and is terrifying, and that's okay. It does not make sense. The Greeks had a lot of different words for love, and they all meant love, and those were the words that were used. And yet...
Wait. Greeks didn't write the Bible.
Greeks wrote the New Testament was written in Greek.
Really?
Yes.
I thought we were talking about the Old Testament.
The Old Testament was written in Hebrew, and they have their own words for love.
I know that, but I mean, like, I thought we were talking about the Hebrew God.
Well, primarily, the ones that he references here are, at one point in the Bible, the, like, hoity-toity Jews, the Pharisees.
Yeah.
They come up to Jesus, they say, hey, what's the most important commandments? He says, first, love the Lord your God, and second, love your neighbor.
Really? I would have been like, yeah, the first 10 are pretty good.
Didn't we already have this conversation?
Probably.
And so that's specifically what he's, like, mentioning and pointing to there. But I'm just bringing in, for one of the many reasons why this doesn't work, the Old Testament ideas as well.
Okay.
In any case,
thank you.
From a language standpoint,
now
it doesn't
I'm just
work.
Imagining some guy like walking up to Jesus and be like, "Which ones? How bad would the murder one be? Is that one of the really is important
that,
ones, or is that like
that
is that lower?
Where's that at?
Is that low?
Is okay. that here? Is that here?
I mean, they're all important." But I mean, like, how important?
In any case, there are many reasons why this is crap, but at the very least, it seems that Daniel Fry, are we agreeing on something? Yes. If nothing else, just this idea that it really, really pisses me off when people are like, oh, you mistranslated that word and it means this instead. It's like, well, no, we have old enough source material to make sure that the translations are correct.
Yeah.
There's literally...
It's not like theology is not like a thing people do.
Yeah. It's
it's not like 3 people are the people that are trying to like read the Bible and understand it and stuff.
It's not as though literally entire colleges, multiple colleges full of people do nothing but study the actual ancient Greek manuscripts all day, every day. That's ridiculous. You, Daniel Fry, talking with the guy from space, you figured it out. Proud of you. So
good job. You and Rosetta Stone, you did it.
Also, oh, Rosetta. So Daniel Fry, he and his Foundation, Understanding Inc., they spread this good word of the alien overlords for 23 years. Now,
that's odd that it's Understanding Inc. when it's very much like a religion.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and the interesting thing about him, we're starting on like, there's a scale here, but all four of the men that we're going to talk about are technically considered like Christian contactees because they took their religious ideas and they baked them into the stories of alien contact. So like, he is definitely not.
I wonder how that happened.
Yeah, right? So essentially, you might be wondering though, 23 years, and yet the aliens were told, or the aliens told him that they only needed 4 more years. What happened there? You want to venture a guess?
They were wrong. They didn't like the next president. I told you.
This
we've had a true one after that.
The one after that. The one after that. This civilization, which has been around since at least 30,000 BC, they were just a little off. Just a little off. Now, Daniel Fry, he sets the stage. He creates the mold. He tells the story, the first story that is still told to this day. The contactee movement is not as I guess, as transparently about aliens as it used to be. You still see in New Age communities all the time people talking about angels or of spiritual beings interacting with them and giving them these kinds of messages. And I would posit that the reason that they're talking about that today is that Daniel Fry started talking like this back in 1949. And it's simply just as the pendulum swung away from aliens being in vogue, the aliens stop being the ones giving the messages.
Right.
As it swings back, as we see it do, the aliens are making more of a reappearance in the modern day and age, I would say. But he sets the groundwork, the foundation. This next man, he builds the house. This is a man by the name of George Adamski. And as I say that, probably at least 20 of you just threw your phone across the room. And that's fine. I don't blame you. Because with Adamski, we begin...
I'm going to rage quit, aren't I?
We begin a look at a phenomena both affectionately and derisively referred to as the Space Brothers. Which is not simply the name. Yep, Jason's flashing the peace sign. This is the hippie movement that I was talking about the last few episodes. Now, this is not just the name of a trance techno dance group that was really big in the UK in the late 90s, although it is the name
really?
Of that.
Really? Yes. You Google searched it,
I had to do in Google.
That's exciting.
The Space Brothers minus techno, minus music, minus band, minus this, minus that, until I finally got usable results. Thank you. No, instead, we're looking at the reports of people who met with beings from beyond this planet, who insists that all they want, very much like what Daniel Fry said, is to live together in peace and love, dude. And we could definitely not do this without bringing up George Adamski. Now, Adamski was a Polish national born in 1891 who immigrated to America with his family in his infancy. In the early 1930s, while living in Southern California, Adamski founded the quote-unquote Royal Order of Tibet, which was a group focused on the exploration of the mystical and the expansion of singular human consciousness into a universal consciousness or intelligence, the likes of which would give us a complete mastery over reality. Does that sound familiar?
Sounds like Doctor Strange and Hive Mind combined.
Well, that's fair. I was hoping it might ring the echo bell of last week talking about wizards who make the weather change simply by thinking really hard. But
I was actually thinking of like how much computing we'd be able to do if we had everyone tied together like that.
I have seen many times a few times, where like the Department of Defense bought like 1,000 PS4s because they were cheap and they made them into a supercomputer. You're saying we should do that
an
with people?
Supercomputer.
You're the Matrix. No. What is wrong with you?
I'm not using them for energy. That's not energy efficient. that is
the biggest,
one of the many flaws that I don't like about the Matrix.
The biggest argument against the Matrix.
You could just be like, hey, we're using their brain power for computing. That would have been better. Well, that's kind of what he's talking about, creating one like hive mind, essentially, with all human consciousness. That would allow us to essentially divvy up, again, like computing program problems between everyone, which means we'd be able to crunch so much data so quick, it'd be cool. But then again, I kind of like being an independent person.
You will be assimilated.
Okay, Legion.
Resistance is futile. I'm Borg. That's Borg from Star Trek.
Star Trek nerd. He's Trekkie.
Now, anyway, this was, of course, years and years before the New Age movement as we know it, but it does, again, build that house, kind of, for it to live in. Because the Royal Order of Tibet made use of a neat little technique that had been relatively recently, about 40 or 50 years earlier, introduced by a group called the Blavatskyists.
That sounds familiar.
Or the Theosophists.
That sounds less familiar.
Okay, well, it should be. I would think it would be the other way around. In any case, these are people who followed the teaching of Helena Blavatsky, who was a mystic of epic proportions. Like,
why do I know that name? Past life.
Probably. You are Helena Blavatsky.
No, I'm not.
You could be.
No, I can't.
Okay. Anyway, so Blavatsky in like the 1880s or 1890s started this movement called Theosophy. She creates the Theosophical Society, which is essentially, it really is the beginning of this modern idea of hidden wisdom and ancient civilizations that were technologically and philosophically advanced that were lost. But we can find this information again. And how do we do that? Well, we communicate with the Ascended Masters. Now, I'm fairly confident we've talked about Ascended Masters before. And if we haven't, then one day, I'm sure that we will go a lot more in depth with them as we will with Blavatsky and Theosophy in general. But essentially, an Ascended Master, as it's currently understood, an Ascended Master is a spiritually involved being. Evolved. I don't know if I said involved.
No,
spiritually
yeah,
evolved.
I'm like, well, that could be
a lot of people. A spiritually evolved being. Someone who used to be a human and then moved beyond that into a new form of existence wherein they transcend time and space.
It's like Buddha?
Yes. Some of your popular ones, as you just guessed, are the Gautama Buddha, Jesus Christ, Confucius. But even those are just the historical figures. Even people like Thoth or Ra, Hades, Zeus, gods, they were real people once who ascended into a literal state of what we puny humans would think of as godhood.
And then they basically became a-holes? Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Their for some of them, their power led them to exercise terrible dominion over the earth.
Hey, power corrupts.
Exactly. And absolute power corrupts, absolutely. Now, of course, the best part of all of this that I'm sure you're just going to love, Jace.
Can't wait.
Is that in order to speak to these ascended masters, you gotta get high. Well, you do, but they don't specifically say that. No, whereas we would think of talking to a god or a higher being as a method of communication from down, us here, up, we're praying or we're directing vibrations or energy, whatever we want to talk about.
Well, I mean, sound does travel through matter in a vibration. So I, yeah.
Perfect. Instead, Blavatsky and, by extension, Adamski thought of it as traveling down. And these higher intelligences and higher beings could be channeled. What this looked like was a person, usually sitting in a chair with their eyes closed, speaking. And as they spoke, the voice of God came through them and revealed secrets of human history that had been lost, but now, oh, glorious day, have been restored by this channeling.
I just tried. I got nothing.
This age-old method of providing 100% real and authentic information regarding the fall of Atlantis 35,000 years ago due to a battle between the followers of black magic and followers of white magic, it was this channeling that Adamski used to set up his own theosophical society offshoot, again, the Royal Order of Tibet. Now here's the interesting thing. This took place in the very early 1930s. You know what else took place in the very early 1930s?
The Depression.
The Depression, but Prohibition. Technically, it started earlier, but it was taking place during this time.
Mm-hmm.
I learned something very fascinating.
Okay.
Which is that due to the extremely important spiritual nature of wine to the world's 1.7 or however many we said last episode, billion Catholics, when the United States outlawed alcohol, they had to make a religious exception. And therefore, churches were the only people who were allowed to either purchase, use, distribute, or in some cases, make their own wine. And that is exactly what George Adamski spent almost all of his time doing while running the Royal Order of Tibet. His own words were that he made enough wine to get all of Southern California drunk. So,
attaboy.
Some people, and it should be noted that this was not just like a guy and he's like, guess what? I started a religion now and I can make wine. He had a commune. People were there. They were living together. They were working together. He was lecturing about philosophy and existentialism in the evenings and working the wine field in the morning. And as far as we can tell, he did make a good amount of cash, both making wine for himself and his followers, and also making it to sell to other churches and the like. However, suspiciously, about the same time that Prohibition was repealed, Adamski decided that the Royal Order of Tibet and the mysteries of the universe could pretty much take a hike, and he didn't want to do that anymore. Who knows why?
Money?
No.
Wine?
I'm sure not. He decided he was going to stick to the soil of the earth. He was going to be a real salt of the earth type, one of them farmers, you know. And he was going to farm the land and live off of it. And it was going to be lovely. And this worked for a period of years. He was self-sufficient. He and some friends still stayed around. And then things didn't go so well, and he ended up literally flipping hamburgers. And that's okay. Flipping burgers is a noble profession. Somebody has to do it. George Adamski did it. But his life just takes this really weird, like, curvature.
I'm fine with that.
It's just very strange. But all of this happened before his life approached the public spotlight. None of this was known to the vast majority of people back in the day.
And then what happened?
Well, good question. He moves near Palomar Mountain. That's where he is doing his farming and this and that, and eventually where he becomes a line cook. And as he's tilling the earth and this and that, he begins to notice some very strange things in the skies above his home. Now, it begins with your good old-fashioned cigar-shaped craft, which he saw multiple times over the years. Then, in 1950... and we'll include this in the show notes, of course, he saw a formation of 6 UFOs flying through the sky in a line. Now, it was at this point that he pulls out his camera and snaps a photo. And the photo depicts 6 lights set on a backdrop of the moon, which is where Adamski claimed to have seen these lights, quote-unquote, take off from to begin with. This would later be included on a commemorative stamp for the tiny island nation of Grenada to mark the year of the UFO. Why? I don't know. He wasn't from Grenada. He had no tie to Grenada. They just thought it was a nice, cool picture and veritable proof of aliens in the world. And it's, I mean, it's an interesting picture.
Yeah.
It's not bad.
It's a picture.
But all it shows is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, maybe 7 lights.
That's set about it.
Set across the backdrop of the moon. There's no shape to the craft or anything like
they're
that.
They're just orbs.
But the real hook to Adamski, the real reason that we're doing this episode, is that in 1952, he, through either genuine experience or hoax, launched a worldwide phenomena, which would drastically alter the public's perception of UFOs and their occupants. Now, I made a big deal at the very beginning about how Daniel Fry was talking about the people inside of the UFOs when nobody else was and communicating, and that's true. But again, keep in mind that he didn't see the people. Now, we can reasonably assume that they probably looked a lot like us because they were our direct genetic ancestors. Now, we've probably changed a little bit, but they were Earthlings, right? And it's that, like, I don't know, Jason, have you seen any old Twilight Zone episodes?
Yeah.
This seemed to be,
yeah,
like,
I've seen a couple.
This was like one of Rod
they
Serling's.
Are really creepy.
They are amazing. I have all of them on.
No, they're wonderful, but really creepy,
yeah,
too.
This is like one of Rod Serling's go-to narrative devices, is like there are people exploring a planet and it's Earth. It's like the Planet of the Apes. Or like there's one specifically where a crew of astronauts go up, they mm-hmm. crash land on a different planet, but it's Earth and they never left in the first place. There's another one where there's an astronaut and he goes through space. He and a woman go through space. You don't learn their names until after they've crash landed. At the very end of the episode, you realize that his name's Adam and her name's Eve and it's Earth, right? And so like this is the standard trope that is being exploited by Daniel Fry, and to be fair, invented in its own way by Daniel Fry. However, what Adamski claims is something very different. And when we talk about him seeing and interacting with the people inside the UFOs, he was really the first one to claim that he was doing it. Now, on November 20th of 1952, Adamski had a feeling. It's a feeling that I understand very well.
Was it a special feeling?
It's a very special, unique feeling that he needed to go to the desert.
Sweet Mojave rain.
I have had this exact feeling of just driving and being like, you need to go to the desert. What are you doing? And I did. I drove up a path that was very too small for my truck, and I sat on top of a little hill, and I watched the sun go down, listened to some music. It was a wonderful time. But what I didn't see was a UFO.
Darn.
And
it was right behind you, Sam.
I'm still trying to find out how to lodge a complaint about that. However, Adamski...
My desert did not do anything I was supposed to do.
Adamski also has this feeling. I need to go to the desert. And Adamski, like any good... a UFO witness should realize that he needed to take people with him into the desert. And so he did. He and a group, I want to say it's 5 other people, it might be 6, they all pile in the car and they just start driving based on what Adamski is feeling. And at a certain point, right after they cross into the area of what is now Joshua Tree National Park, Adamski has the feeling that he no longer has to go to the desert. He is in the desert, and now he needs to wait. And so he does. And after a time, a cigar-shaped craft appears in the sky, very similar to others that he had seen before at a distance, but with this one being as relatively close as it was, he realized that it was more reminiscent of a submarine than a cigar. Now, this feeling that Adamski had, this go to the desert, you're in the desert, wait in the desert. Now it said, go to the craft. and go alone. And so he began to walk. He leaves his friends and wanders across the desert wilderness, which is also something that I did in the desert. But as opposed to me, whereas I simply got very confused by the moon, Mr. Adamski came face to face with something supernatural. Now, what he
was
sees...
Was it a burning bush?
No. No, that you're thinking of Moses.
Oh.
But good try.
Yeah.
Now, as he makes his way closer to the main craft, he sees a smaller craft exit it. It comes out of the big cigar-shaped submarine floating in the air, and then it disappears. That one, the big one, does.
Well, he just shot a torpedo, clearly.
Abandoned ship. Now, this craft, which was descending to the earth at quite a speed, was described by Adamski of being a translucent metal, and an exquisite, shimmering color, almost appearing more glass than metal. Now, the shape of it...
How do you know it was metal?
Because it was metal. He knew it was metal. And the shape of it was very akin to a bell, which had three balls on the bottom as landing gear. Now, this craft landed quite near to him, and out of it came a man. The man was about a quarter of a mile away, and he beckoned to Adamski to come closer. He was described by Adamski thusly. Quote, he was round-faced, with an extremely high forehead, large but calm gray-green eyes, slightly aslant at the outer corners, slightly higher cheekbones than an Occidental, a finely chiseled nose, an average-sized mouth with beautiful white teeth that shone when he smiled or spoke. The beauty of his form surpassed anything I had ever seen. I felt like a little child in the presence of one with great wisdom and much love. And I became very humble within myself. From him was radiating a feeling of infinite understanding and kindness with supreme humility. And then he describes his clothes, unquote. And then he describes his clothes, which was a reddish-brown jumpsuit, saying, quote, his trousers were not like mine. So that's how he knew he was an alien. Because his trousers were not like mine. Now, the two tried to awkwardly establish communication through verbal speech and then hand signals. And essentially...
Wait. So the aliens...
Yeah.
...that were talking to him in his mind.
No, these wait, aliens, different person. Yep, that was Daniel Fry. Good try.
Okay, good.
Not yet, though.
So they're different aliens.
Different aliens.
Than the ones that visited
He's
Fry.
Seeing the alien. Fry never sees the alien.
Right.
Yeah.
So how many different species of aliens are there out there?
Oh, buddy.
Oh, God. Okay.
You got your Pleiadians.
Nope.
You got your Luciferians.
Nope.
Yep, that's
keep
a
going.
Thing. Wait, keep going with the aliens aliens?
Pause that.
One alien.
Yeah, the alien.
Fair.
So the hand signals.
Basically, yeah, they start with hand signals. And in this way, they knew that they were both talking about Venus, the planet. And so Adamski says, Venus, and the alien says, Venus, and then he points to himself in a very Tarzan kind of way and says, George, and then the alien points to himself and says, Orthon, because that was his name, Orthon, and at that point, a telepathic communication channel was opened between the two of them. And they started to converse about all sorts of things. And Adamski says, are you really an alien from Venus? And Orthon says, I am. Because that's what he sounds like in his head. He doesn't sound like whiny little frickin' nerd.
But you're not.
And is surprised to find out, Orthon and the Vesuvians, they are Vesuvians. That would be something different. The Venusians, they believe in the same abstract universal creator force that Adamski does. What a shock. And he realizes that this ship came from Venus. And the reason it came from Venus? It was because they needed to get to the bottom of what Orthon described as these atomic booms that had been detected. And this was of the utmost importance.
Why? It's a planet away.
He has to.
No, he doesn't.
Because when you set off, this goes back to what we were talking about before. When you set off a nuclear weapon, you create a disturbance that goes beyond your own localized space-time.
Yeah, but the stuff that's occurring out in space is way more powerful than a nuke.
Not according to Orthon. And Orthon's that's the thing. Orthon doesn't know crap. That's the thing, is that like...
Orthon's living on a planet that has like lightning all the time in acidic atmosphere.
Not
so
if you... No, he doesn't. Thank
good,
you.
Good
nope,
luck.
Nope, you're wrong. We'll get
or
to that
any
in
kind
moment.
Of organism living there.
So, thank you. So...
Yes, stupid.
What does Orthon say?
Alien
so this
you.
Is the difference, right? Is that, yes, he is concerned and the Venusians are concerned that the Earthlings are going to wipe themselves out. That's definitely a problem. But this also affects them in a way. Their destinies are tied together, which is something different than what we get out of Fry's narrative. That makes it seem like an Earth-centric problem that needs an Earth-centric solution. Whereas here, we see the beginnings of some sort of a higher organizational period between interplanetary forces, something that will become known over time as the Space Brothers, but we're not quite there yet. Now, Orthon takes Adamski to see his ship. And as he does, Adamski touches the ship, which I guess he wasn't supposed to do, which I don't know why you'd take him to see it if you're not supposed to touch it. But he touches it, and his arm goes numb, and he gets thrown away. And he also takes 6 pictures.
Oh, no, you shouldn't have done that.
You shouldn't have done that now. Get your hands off my lucky charms.
Okay.
And Adamski also takes 6 pictures, but the pictures are either lost to time or, as Adamski will later claim, he totally has the pictures. But the problem is that the magnetic field of the craft rendered the photos unusable after the fact.
So he doesn't have pictures.
He doesn't have pictures, no.
Cool.
He also tried to take a picture of Orthon, but Orthon declined, which is strange because why would you need to decline if it wasn't going to work anyway? Who knows? Instead, Orthon requests a blank photographic plate from Adamski, which he gives over. And at this point, Orthon says his goodbyes, and he leaves. And they've talked a bit.
It's like if I was using one of those disposable cameras, and uh-huh. He's like, hey, do you mind if I borrow the tape in that? Sure, man. Okay, bye.
Bye. This is mine now. Exactly. And
same idea.
They communicated a bit. They talked about, you know, don't be making nuclear weapons now, and you got to be careful and all that. Otherwise, you're going to blow yourselves up and affect us as well.
Too bad for my homemade nuke kick that I just bought.
And the idea, what's really interesting is that when you look at the contactees, as we will continue to do next week, just in case you've forgotten, is that they are perfectly aware that there is a better way of doing this, which is talking to the actual leaders of the world, but they also say that the leaders of the world aren't going to listen to them. There's nothing they can do. And so it falls on the people. And in that way, I kind of used it tongue-in-cheek earlier to describe Daniel Fry, but these people are essentially apostles of an intergalactic gospel of peace, of this idea that they have to go to all the nations and proclaim the good news of the ET intelligence and consciousness and contact. And if they don't, then mankind is poised to destroy themselves and, in some cases, everybody else with them. Now, Orthon leaves. However, less than a month later, Orthon would return. On December 13th, 1952, while Adamski was working on his telescope, he was alarmed by the huge amount of military planes passing overhead. Now, he used his telescope to surveil the planes and the sky in general for a period of about 3 hours. And finally, at 9 a.m., something very interesting happens. Out of nowhere, all of the military craft in the area seem to disappear. And that same bell-shaped iridescent glass structure appears. Now, it doesn't land. It doesn't make contact. What happens is the bottom of it opens and a hand comes out. And the hand is holding the photographic plate. And the hand drops the plate. And the hand waves goodbye. And the spaceship takes off and leaves. Adamski goes out to retrieve it. Now, what he finds is that the photographic plate, the negative, has been inscribed with all of these weird random symbols. And what's interesting is that back then, about a month ago, as
it took
they
a
were,
month to do, is that the interesting part?
About a month ago, as they were in the desert, when Orthon left, his feet, his boots, left imprints of these same bizarre symbols. Now, after Adamski and Orthon finished
so
talking,
he stepped on it.
Ah, crap!
Oh, I broke it.
Better give it back
anymore.
To George now. Bye bye. After they had finished talking the first time, what was interesting is that Adamski goes back to his colleagues and they all say, wow, I just saw a spaceship and a man came out of it and talked to you for a period of about 15 to 20 minutes and then he disappeared. And he said, wow, that's right. And they all went together and they all saw the footprints and they took a cast of the footprints. But while the cast has been sketched and remembered, it is effectively lost as well. But this...
Not the first time that's happened to a plate.
No. This cast, these symbols all matched up with the symbols on the photographic negative. Now, whoa. The only symbol, though, that they could decipher...
Wow.
Wow. The only symbol they could decipher or even understand, and this really sucks, was that of a swastika. For some reason, Orthon's boot had a swastika on it. And the plate, I think we all know why, the plate also had the same symbol. Now, we'll get back to that.
Well, I mean, the swastika wasn't necessarily a sign of hatred.
It was in 1952.
Yeah. Thanks, Hitler.
Thanks, Hitler. I know, it used to, I mean...
It used to mean friendship or peace, something like that? Like,
peace.
Yeah, like, it was
and
a positive...
You, it was a very symbol. Common... The same way that you see the fleur-de-lis used all over the place, the swastika used to be. And you'd have hockey clubs that it was their insignia, and beer brewing companies. And it's an Eastern symbol to begin with. So it starts, and you'll still see Eastern iconography produced in the modern day with it.
And Hitler's just like, eh, let's just like just rotate it as hair.
Exactly. And just ruin it for everybody.
Turn it into a diamond instead of a square.
What a jerk. For many, many reasons.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, what's most important, though, it's not even this photographic plate that's returned. What's important is that as soon as Adamski saw the craft appear the second time, he takes his camera and he shoves the camera in the telescope, and then he points the telescope at the spaceship, and then he takes a picture. And this is a picture that we have, a real, quote-unquote, real picture of a real flying saucer. And Jason, it's here in the notes, and I'm, of course, going to put it in the show notes. What do you think about this?
It looks like the lamp that my dentist used to use.
That's so interesting that you say that.
Oh, no.
I would recommend that everybody either Google George Adamski UFO or go to notalonepodcast.com/ColdWar3, and you will see this picture there. It does look a little like a lamp, doesn't it?
Yes, Sam, it does. Now, what did you just let me walk into?
Well, all of that is to say that there is some very real concern about these pictures. Now, to some people...
Because we don't have any reference objects
that's
for size.
A concern. He actually took a video as
ooh.
Well at one point. Yeah, and that also exists out there, but I couldn't find anything that wasn't like a 6-minute analysis of like 18 frames of video. And I was like, I don't want this. That's going to take forever. And so you can go find that as well. But essentially it shows a less defined bell-shaped object hovering in the sky. To a lot of people, regardless of what this looks like to us today, and it should be noted that most modern ufologists and anyone worth their salt doesn't believe George Adamski as far as they can throw him, but...
Then why are we talking about him?
To the because this is important. This is directly the contacting movement, which becomes the abduction movement, both of which broil into the New Age movement. It happens because of World War II and the Cold War. Like, without the Cold War, these stories would not have the fertile ground with which to be planted and to grow into lifelong efforts of storytelling and magical UFOs and this and that and the other thing. That's why we're talking about it, and that's why we're going to talk about it all over again next week. And if you don't like it, I'm sorry. I worked really hard on it.
You have. I can tell. All I can say is, see what you did, world.
See what you done. Now,
you made this happen.
These photos and the video, they provided for some indisputable evidence. I mean, this is the kind of thing that turned people overnight from complete skeptics to complete true believers. And it reminds me of one time when there was a balloon in the Thanksgiving Day Parade, Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade.
You got it.
Of like a dinosaur that got loose, that found its way to a beach, that crashed on the beach, and everybody thought it was a sea monster, and they didn't think it was a balloon. And it
sounds
kind of like
right.
that. So this, though, it really did affect the people who saw it. And he was able to write a series of three different books based on this, because he had multiple other meetings with Orthon as well, which we're going to get into in just a moment. But on the other side, not everybody was as ready to believe, even just right off the bat.
No.
There was one man named Walter Rydell, who was a German rocket scientist, who claimed that the photograph was an obvious fraud, that the so-called saucer was nothing more than a high-powered lamp, and that the landing gear of it were light bulbs. He even claims that if you look hard enough, you can see the GE logo emblazoned on at least one of them, primarily the center. Now, this is the most common and to this day most well-accepted explanation of this photograph. However, at the time, Adamski was able to produce some really serious documentation with signed letters from MGM and Hollywood directors. Like, literally, the movie magic people of the day came out and said, like, I couldn't fake this. I don't... This is not using any techniques that I could do. This has to be authentic because I literally fake things for a living, and I wouldn't even know where to start with this. As well as you had aerospace engineers who had direct experience working specifically with models, as well as photography experts. All these people coming out on the other side saying, I think this is the real deal. I've done my own analysis and drawing on this, that, and the other. These are real pictures.
Sure, they're real pictures.
Real pictures of a real craft flying through the air.
Well, someone has some craft.
All right. There were even reports from other people claiming to see the same bell-shaped craft everywhere in other parts of the world. Places like Southern California.
Even in their own home. I'm sorry, I'm done.
No, it's good. Even to places like Great Britain, although no additional photographs have been provided. One really interesting footnote on this, and I don't make anything out of it at all, is that there was actually a UFO reported from an outside source. None of the people that was there with Adamski on that day in 1952. There was a UFO reported in the same area, a cigar-shaped craft in the same area on that day, which you can see in the Project Blue Book files. So, there's this idea, based on that, based on the fact that some of the footage may be authentic while others are definitely not, that maybe something happened to Adamski and he needed to create proof. He needed to manufacture the photos that would cause people
to believe. He needed to discredit himself, yeah.
You have a very Ed Walters situation here. However, whereas Ed Walters, as one day we will talk about with Rob when he's back in full force, Ed Walters' model of the UFO that he used was eventually found.
What?
Yeah. It was eventually found. Adamski's never was. However, people, as time go on, they distance themselves from Adamski, and you had individuals signing affidavits saying that they were there and they saw it when it was proved that they weren't anywhere close to it and they never saw anything of the like. And so Adamski's case of Orthon Adamski's case of other beings as well that he interacted with, because he didn't just see the UFO from outside. He went inside. As he went inside, he took a trip around the solar system. One place that he saw was, of course, Venus. And Jason, what? How would you describe the surface of Venus? You did it just a few minutes ago.
I think it's an acidic atmosphere of just storm.
Okay.
Isn't it just like electrical storms? Let's find out for sure.
Well, you're wrong.
What is it?
It is a verdant, green, luscious paradise.
You shut your face.
Completely habitable by man. And what's really interesting is that some people will even say that that's not, and I stress some being very few, but some people will say that there's an explanation for that. There's a reason why Adamski saw Venus as a paradise, whereas we see it pretty much like you were saying. I'm pretty sure it's just a ball of sulfur and lightning and acid rain. Like, it's not a very inviting place to be. You could not survive there. You would die. And yet people claim that when you're talking about aliens and you're talking about Orthon and the aliens specifically in our solar system, because he didn't just meet with the Venusians, he met with the Martians, of course, and he met with the, who were the last ones? He met with the, I don't know how to pronounce it, so I'm just going to say the people from Saturn. The people from Saturn as well. And each of these planets we know now is uninhabitable. But in this typical modern revisionist style that so many of the truly true believers in the contactee movement will take, they say, well, it's because we're working with different dimensions.
Ah, so, sorry.
No, you're
Venus,
fine.
Temperatures can approach 900 degrees Fahrenheit, and the atmospheric pressure is 92 times what we feel here on Earth.
Yeah, and that's
true.
It's
a lot of pressure.
That's true in this dimension.
It's like mom and dad wanted me to go back to school. Practically the same.
But in other dimensions, higher or lower, Venus is a paradise. And so is Mars. And so is Saturn. And all of the planets of the solar system are inhabited by this interplanetary force of the Space Brothers.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Carbon dioxide clouds, sulfuric acid. There we go.
We are being invited into membership in this group of like-minded, and the important thing is here, human individuals. The Venusians, really it's a term that is modern ufology understood to be Nordic. Nordic aliens is what we would call them. They're white people, they have blonde hair, they're extremely beautiful. Like, and they're human beings, and they look like us and talk like us and act like us. They're just from different places, and they're better than us. This is what mankind is supposed to be. And yet here on Earth, for whatever reason...
This is getting slightly racist.
It is. It is. Again, ufology has a lot of inherent racism in it. We've addressed it
in general as well. So.
Well, that's true. We've addressed it talking about, like, with ancient astronaut theory and like the idea that, well, of course they couldn't do this because they were just primitive savages. Well, okay, but you get more people saying that aliens built the pyramids than aliens built Stonehenge or anything other that white people did. So like, I don't know. I always shy away from the ancient astronaut theories mainly because of that undercurrent. And I know that the vast majority of people who like talk that way and think that way, they're not consciously doing it, but it just betrays that underlying idea that unless you are European, your society cannot produce great works of things unaided. The same thing happens here. All of the good people from outer space are white, and they're white, and they're blonde, and they're beautiful. And it's no...
I mean, same thing with our angels from last week.
Yeah, exactly. It's no wonder that the ideas of Helena Blavatsky, who again, like the theosophical movement doesn't explicitly deal with extraterrestrials in this way, but like that mysticism and this and that, it directly led to the idea, like that's where the word or where the concept of the Aryan race comes from is from Blavatsky. Like, that's one of her four root races of man. Like, this is an inherently harmful thing, especially if you're not aware of it. If you're aware of it and then you want to go looking, cool, go look, go exploring, just keep all of this in mind. But when people are just looking up things and then suddenly they find themselves believing that all the aliens look just like white people and they don't look like anybody else because, you know, like, that's where you get a problem. And that's where a lot of problems come with the contactee movement. Not all of them, though. Again, you do have contactees seeing people of color. You have contactees seeing women, but unfortunately, usually the women are, like, cartoonishly, like...
proportioned.
Yes, exactly. And it's just a weird field to be in. However, let's go ahead and let's say that what Adamski saw was real, that it happened. There are a few different ideas as to what it actually was if it wasn't aliens themselves. The first is that the CIA used Adamski, either willingly or unwillingly, as a method of disinformation. He went about telling these stories of the Venusians and the Martians trying to bring us all into peace and brotherhood because they were staged by the CIA. So that way, whenever anybody talked about the people inside the saucers, as he was really one of the first to talk about the people inside the saucers, they would think that you were crazy to talk about those people. Because you don't have an issue saying that UFOs are real at this point. The majority of the public did. But you couldn't talk about what was inside of them without sounding like a loon. The other idea is that the CIA used him willingly and that he made up these stories. He was a disinformation agent. And he did travel all over the world telling these stories and, again, spreading that good, good alien gospel. And as he did, there were weird rumors of him using, like, a special diplomatic passport that he couldn't have gotten through normal means. Or other stories of people, like, trying to... At one point, he got sued for mail fraud, but, like, not in the normal way of mail fraud. It was essentially that his book was fraudulent, and he was doing it by mail order, and so they tried to bring a suit against him. But supposedly, the director of the CIA stepped in and was like, no.
We can't touch this guy. We
can't touch this. When in reality, he just said... That's not our jurisdiction, but somehow it got corrupted to the director of the CIA, said hands off. The other idea, it's quite interesting, is one that has to do with, like we mentioned a little earlier, Nazis. Now, in the early 1990s, a whole slew of documents were released that had to do with Nazi military plans, military technology, this, that, and the other. And what we found is that in 1943, there was a craft that was in development by the Nazis, which was called the Hanibu 2, or the Haunebu 2, H-A-U-N-E-B-U 2. And it looks exactly like this craft. Like, it is down to the frickin' holes, the vents. It looks exactly like the thing that was photographed. And we know that this is an actual technology that was supposedly in development by the Nazis and the German army.
Well, it doesn't look exactly like it.
No?
So what,
there's,
what are
oh,
the...
Really quick. There's in the show notes here, we have a comparison of the two side by side. So go take a look at those. Go ahead,
and,
Jason.
And the reason why I say they don't is because it's pretty obvious that the... small domes, the three domes,
mm-hmm.
that's making the triangle, that those aren't landing gears. It's pretty obvious that those are essentially like a machine gun turret.
Guns, yeah.
Otherwise, it looks like the base might actually have some sort of weird thruster, while on the actual pictures, it's more of another dome on the underside of it.
Right.
So, I mean, they're not exact. They're very, very, very close.
I'd say they're 95%.
And
would you say
also,
that?
We cannot see a really much of a pronounced dome
on the
top.
Well,
of
just
the,
because
the UFO,
of the angle.
Because of the angle.
But that's only on this picture. On the actual video,
but,
there
know,
is a dome.
As a kid, I also
drew Gundams, and I could also declare that being in development.
Sure. I'm not saying that the Nazis made flying saucers. Maybe okay. I'm saying that. Who knows? I could be, but I'm probably not. But everybody else is. Not everybody. Some people. And they literally believe that Germans, for some reason, showed up in Southern California in this 7 years after the fall, after the fall of the Third Reich, showed up in Southern California in this weird UFO craft in order to, I don't know, sow the seeds of dissension or to create confusion or panic. There's really no good explanation because there's not a good follow-up to this. The craft.
I'm not going
to
lie, though. There's definitely plenty of area to slap on a really nice-looking swastika on this thing. So if that's the case, I don't think the Nazis did it.
That's fair. That's fair. They missed their opportunity.
They were very good at propaganda. So clearly, they didn't want to be seen as Nazis. So yeah.
Thank you. Again, Adamski was, if the Nazis were going to appear to anybody in the United States in 1952, Adamski was as good a candidate as any. I'm not saying he was a Nazi.
You're not saying he's anti-Semitic? Okay.
No, just because of his theosophical leanings and his again, dependency on the work of Blavatsky, which the Nazis as well drew a lot of inspiration from. Now, in 1953, Adamski published a book called Flying Saucers Have Landed. He followed this up in 1955 with another book called Inside the Spaceships. He claims that his December encounter, the second encounter with Orthon, was not his last, like I mentioned, and that he went on many interplanetary journeys with spacemen who showed him cities on the moon, the surprisingly vibrant and livable habitat of Venus, again, interdimensionally. So in this dimension, it's a terrible wasteland. In their dimension, it's a veritable Garden of Eden. And over the years, Adamski wrote even more books. He traveled the world preaching the gospel of the UFOs, and he would go all in to fall for a confirmed hoax regarding a letter from a so-called government official claiming that a number of high-ranking government men planned to go public with their support of his claims. At other points, he would be received by the Queen of the Netherlands, which was confirmed to actually happen, and allegedly meet with Pope John the 23rd, just days before his death, to give him a message from the extraterrestrials. He claims to have gotten a little trinket, a gold medal of honor from the Pope for his service to humanity, but it's been since discovered that the same medal of honor can be purchased in tourist shops all over the Vatican and Rome, for that matter. Now, as time went
on... So he really forgot that he was honoring him. It was like, I have to pick something up.
That's thanks for thinking like an Adamskiite. I appreciate that. Now, as time went on, his former supporters, including people who lived at his commune with him and supposedly witnessed the UFOs with them, they began to walk their statements back, or else they would straight up accuse Adamski of lying and admitted that they did as well. But another particularly damning statement came from a man by the name of Raymond A. Palmer, who was an editor of Amazing Stories, which was an anthology of sci-fi, a magazine. Now, on a late-night radio program, Palmer was quoted as saying, quote, "I don't mean to say that I think George Adamski is a liar, but here's a fact about Mr. Adamski that isn't generally known, and I haven't publicized to a great extent for the simple reason that I don't believe it would do any good to really attack him. But when I was the editor of Amazing Stories back in about 1939 or 1940, I'm vague on the date, it was much before flying saucers, I received a manuscript from George Adamski that he thought ought to be published in Amazing Stories. Well, I read it. It was the story of a spaceship which came to Earth, and the pilot of the spaceship was Jesus Christ. And the message, of course, was a message of peace and goodwill and about how we all ought to get along. Well, I disagreed with Mr. Adamski," which is such an interesting, like, what do you disagree with there? That we should all get along? I disagreed with Mr. Adamski, and I told him so, and I regretfully rejected the manuscript, but I enjoyed personally reading it, and so on. Now, this was Adamski's first book. In that same manuscript, the only changes made were a spaceship to a flying saucer and Jesus Christ to a Venusian. So, he's basically saying he read it all a decade before Adamski published it under this new idea. And when we look back at the Royal Order of Tibet suspiciously rising and declining with prohibition, when we see stories of most likely fake encounters with the Vatican and higher up, when we see him falling for hoaxes and this and that, to me, those speak more to Adamski's credibility than his photos or videos ever will, because you can go back and forth all day. There's no way, unless I can pull it out and hold it in my hand, that I can prove without the shadow of a doubt that this is a lamp, even though it really looks like a lamp and I believe it to be a lamp. There's always that opportunity for someone to say, well, if it's in the, but there is no opportunity to say that Adamski wasn't a lying cheat for at least the first half of his life, and that he went on not to become fabulously rich, but to be wealthy enough to never really have to work again beyond giving lectures at UFO conferences. And honestly, if I could get just famous enough to do that, I'd probably do the same thing. It seems like a good life. It seems like the life I'd want to live. Now, Adamski, according to Adamski, Earth and Venus, they were not unique in their ability to host intelligent life that suspiciously looks very, very, very much like each other. Adamski, like I said, he claimed to meet Martians. He met the people who live on Saturn. He sat with the 1,000-year-old philosopher king of the Intergalactic Federation, of which these beings were a part, and he wanted to draw Earth and its inhabitants into this conglomeration as well, to provide a golden peace. Golden age of peace and prosperity. This is the idea of the Space Brothers. This is the idea that the people out there aren't as far away as we would think they are, and that they look a lot more like us than we think they do, and that they have a vested, not a vested bad interest, which is the more modern, like, abduction. Like, we're getting abducted and it's bad, and they're using us for cattle and whatever, but a vested interest because of love and intergalactic harmony. The good side to the New Age duality. Now, Captain Edward J. Ruppelt, again, he was the first head of the Project Blue Book type projects at the Air Force. And he had this to say about Adamski's claim and why people followed them. He said, quote, "The common undertone to many of these contactee stories is utopia. On these other worlds, there is no illness. They've learned how to cure all diseases. There are no wars, for they've lived how to live peacefully. There is no poverty. Everyone has everything he wants. There is no old age. They've learned the secret of eternal life." Too many times, this subtle pitch can be boiled down to step right up, folks, and put a donation in the pot. I'm just on the verge of learning the spaceman's secret, and with a little money to carry out my work, I'll give you the secret. And that's where we leave George Adamski. We've really only touched the surface on him, as bizarre as that sounds. There are books about him, there are his books, there are books about those books, and there are books about those books. The one that I use the most in that section is called Looking for Orthon, the Story of George Adamski, the First Flying Saucer Contactee, and How He Changed the World by Colin Bennett. That'd be a great resource for anyone who wants to learn more. But for my money, and I think for Jason's as well, Adamski is a hoaxer. He's a fiend. He's a scoundrel and an unscrupulous liar to most, but to others, his message of peace rings true. He's worthy of his very own series, and I don't think I can ever convince Jason to let me give that to him now.
Is that's what we're doing right here? This is
no, all he, this is half an episode.
It's a mini-series.
That's fair. But next week, if Fry built the foundation and Adamski built the walls.
Oh no. Who built the ceiling?
We'll talk about
where's the roof.
We'll talk about who built the second story, the roof.
No.
And finally, the man who capped it all with a weather vane next week.
Three more people?
No, two people.
Okay.
The ceiling and the roof and the second story, those are all one guy. And
wow,
the
that's
one
a lot of work.
I know. He did the most work, I would say. And then the one to cap it next week. For anyone in the know who has a understanding of contactees as is, these names will mean something. Everybody else, they won't. Next week, we'll be talking about George Van Tassel and Orfeo Angelucci.
Right over my head.
Yep.
Both of them.
So, damn, that's 2 hours right there.
How
that
we
done. So, I don't have much else to say, Jason. Do you?
I have a migraine.
You have a migraine. I do have this to say, which is, I love you all. Secondly, we are doing, again, part 2 of part 3 next week, which will be part 4. 3B. We're doing 3B next week. After that, because we have another fairly big subject that we'll be covering and a special event that I'm going to plan to go along with that, we are going to actually take a week off after next week. So we'll do contactees 1 this week, contactees 2 next week, week off, and then we'll be back with a what I hope to be one of our bigger shows. So
to sum pretty much this whole episode up, is that early contactees essentially is just a alien spinoff of religion.
Yeah, that'd be a start.
In most ways.
That'd be a start.
I mean, the utopia idea, the prophesizing, all of that are parallel to many different religious formats.
Yes. Next week, we'll be talking with George Van Tassel about the
Really?
First,
we're going to be talking with him?
Well,
can't wait.
In regards to George Van Tassel, who has been dead for a very long time, we'll be talking about
Get the Ouija board out.
What most people accept as the first UFO religion, because these are general messages of peace. They're not as structured. And Van Tassel doesn't actually bring in the unifying structure, but he leaves the door open for others to do so, as we'll see next week. So that's all I'm going to say for now.
Wait.
That's, I know you can't, right? You're so excited.
Oh, not excited. Oh, boy.
Before we go, we do want to thank two people. The first one is Kelsey M.F. Hill for leaving us a review on iTunes. Thank you, Kelsey. She says, witty banter, funny hosts, I love Not Alone. Jason and Sam are like the odd couple of spooky stories. I appreciate the skeptic angle, along with Sam being unabashedly afraid of everything. Thank you. Keep up the good work, guys. And then secondly, we would like to thank our one new patron this week, which is Gino Moscati.
Gino,
thank you so much for contributing to the podcast. If you'd like to learn how you can become a sponsor, are you gonna say something?
No,
he's dead. If you'd like to learn how you can become a sponsor, you can go to patreon.com/notalonepodcast, get early episodes, as well as some bonus content and all of that. Beyond that, if you can't write an iTunes review, if you can't donate, just tell a friend, or just keep tuning in week after week. Either one of those are going to be wonderful ways you can support the show. You can find us on Twitter at Not Alone Pod. You can find me on Twitter at Beerlord Elfbane, and Jason is at
Mighty Moit.
Mighty Moit. You can find us on Facebook at Not Alone Podcast and join our Facebook discussion and meme page group. Remember, we are not alone, a community for the strange. You can email us at notalonepodcast@gmail.com. And if you have your own personal paranormal story you'd like to submit for consideration in any of our upcoming listener specials, you can do that at notalonepodstories@gmail.com. Jason, I did it last week because it was really long, and actually the outro music wasn't long enough to cover it, and so I had a weird time editing it last week, so
good.
I'll let you do it this week.
Remember, whether you're discovering someone new for the first time, or finding footprints that make you a little worried, you are not alone.